is where I think I join in a partnership with God. I love old Hal M. from Washington, D.C. always talks about his partnership with God. And he said, God's a senior partner and I'm the junior partner. He said, God's in charge of long-term planning and I'm in charge of day-to-day operations. And he said, but any time during the course of the day, I want to check and see how the day-to-day operations fit in with a long-term plan, I call on my senior partner and he helps me. And that really says it well to me, I think. I think the whole thing has to do with bringing on a new partner. And that's why the guys I sponsor, when it comes to the seven-step prayer, third-step prayer, I get on my knees with them when they pray. And I'm with them. And I usually say a little prayer for them before they pray. And then they pray the third-step prayer. The seventh-step prayer, I say, you go in there and you talk to God. Because this is with you and God. This isn't about me. This is where you're making a decision to join in to a relationship with God. And you're going to ask him to take all your assets and all your liabilities and use them both. And that's a wonderful, wonderful contract. I know I spent a long time on 6 and 7. And the reason I have is because I just think it's critically important. I think 6 and 7, it's so easy to overlook. And yet, character building is what this is about. I could define, Bill recommended it when we do 12-step work, that we talk of, and Dr. Silkworth recommended this, that we talk about the progression of the illness. That's what he recommended we talk about. Because it's in the progression of the illness that I recognize that I have this thing called alcoholism. Okay? It's in the deterioration of my life and the progression of the illness that I recognize it. It's not because I drink too much. I served in the Marine Corps with a lot of guys who drink too much. They drank too much on several occasions. But it didn't cost them. They didn't pay for it with their character, and their self-respect and all the rest of it. They got drunk and made a fool out of themselves from time to time. But it was different. My drinking was different than other people's drinking. You know the three guys that I joined with in Pittsburgh? The day I was discharged in 1965, all four of us were together again for the first time in 4 years. We had not run into one another at all during these 4 years. We were all four the same rank. And one had been in Okinawa and the other on the West Coast, and I'd been mostly on the East Coast in Europe and the Caribbean, and one was in the Air Wing in Iwakuni, Japan or something. And so we all met at dispersing. We were all discharged from Camp Lejeune. We all met at dispersing. We laughed, shook hands and stuff, and we were all getting out. And I said, let's go to the NCO club and have a sandwich. He said, that's a great idea. And we were all anxious to leave. We were just all anxious to get out of there. So we went over to the NCO club and we had a beer and a sandwich. And the three of them were still anxious to leave. And I said, what's the hurry? We've been here, we've been in this for 4 years. Let's have another beer. And I said, well, all right, one more, but then I'm getting out of here. My girlfriend's waiting or my parents are waiting or whatever it might be. And they had the next one, and they left. And then I had another one, and another one, and another one. And I got home 10 days later. That's an alcoholic. Okay? That's an alcoholic. And I could see the progression of the illness. When I went in there, I meant to have one goodbye beer with these guys. And I got home 10 days later. They got home the same day. I mean, I remember, even actually remember some of the 10 days. I mean, I remember I was in Charleston, West Virginia, and I was drinking with a guy and four women, and it turned out that he was a pimp who was going to Moundsville State Penitentiary, and his girls were having a party for him before he went. He had to serve 2 years for soliciting prostitution, and they asked me to join them. And I mean, I'm a social guy, so I joined him. And then the next, and it's like pictures, it's like still frames, The next thing I know, I'm driving this Cadillac convertible up in front of Moundsville State Penitentiary in Moundsville, West Virginia. And these girls are crying, and I'm crying, and we're saying goodbye to this guy and everything. And then the next thing I know, I'm back in Charleston, and I'm alone. And what was amazing about driving was I didn't know how to drive. I didn't have a driver's license or anything, but I was driving that pimp mobile from Charleston to... And Moundsville was only about 20 miles from where I was ultimately headed. And I end up back in Charleston, And finally I get home and my parents are just crazy with worry. They had no idea what had happened to me. They knew I was getting out and coming home. And you know, all the balloons. My sister was a budding Al-Anon. She left the balloons with all the air out of them up just so I could see the decorations and the party that I missed. And all that stuff. And I mean, it's just an insane, crazy way to live your life. And then that was the good part. And it got much, much worse than that. And the point of all that is that I could determine I was an alcoholic based upon the deterioration of my life. Well, I can determine whether or not the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous are working for me based upon the appreciation of my life. I ask myself this question. Am I more the man I want to be this time this year than I was this time last year? And if the answer is no, I'm not doing it right. When I was in the throes of alcoholism, I could see through the 12 years I drank that every year I was worse than I was the year before. I was less the person I wanted to be. I may have looked more successful. I may have had more things hanging on my wall. I may have published more papers or whatever. But I was less the person I wanted to be than I'd been the year before. And the fantastic aspect of being a member of Alcoholics Anonymous and a sober, active member of Alcoholics Anonymous is I can be more the person I want to be this time next year than I am this time this year. This time next year I can be a better husband, a better friend, a better son, a better brother than I am this time this year. And that's the beauty of this. And that's the essence of the seventh step. The essence of the seventh step is improving. Become more and more the way God would have always wanted me to be. And that's when I experience His love. I experience His love in the forgiveness and everything, of course, but I really experience His love in our partnership, in our relationship. As I say in my 10th step at night, in my 11th step at night, when I do that, I say, boy, I did that the way you wanted me to do it today, didn't I? I didn't do it the way I did it before. I did it better today. Thank you. And I feel more and more akin to Him. Let me sort of introduce the 8th step, and then we'll take a break, okay? The 8th step, and I feel bad for you folks sitting. Made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Now, we know, of course, with the 8th step that this 8th step began with our 4th step. You know, there were a number of people listed on my 4th step, okay, and that was the beginning of my 8th step. And the 8th step process is a very interesting one, and I wanted to tell you how I do it. The book isn't real specific about how to do it. It just says what we're supposed to do. So we make a list, and I remember Sandy said to me, he said, how you doing? How you come with your 8th step? I said, well, I said, I'm working on it. And he said, you got a list? I said, no. He said, then you're not working on it. So he said, because it said made a list. That's the first thing you do. So he took it, my yellow pad, my number 2 pencil that I can't lie, and he wrote list, L-I-S-T. He said, now start listing the people. And he said, start with the ones on your 4th step. So I began to list people and stuff. Then he had me to do something very, very interesting. After I listed all the people, okay, he had me sit down with him and go through each one and explain to him why I thought I needed to make an amends to them. Okay, some of them were cut and dry. You know, I took stuff that belonged to them and made it mine. It's called stealing. And that's easy, you know. The Gulf Oil Company, I bought a battery and put it on my credit card and moved and yet didn't give a forwarding address. Okay? That's easy. Dear Gulf Oil Company, in 1972, I bought a battery, fine battery, from your company. And I didn't, all this stuff, and I want to pay you for that battery. So I sent him the money, right? So I get this nice letter back with a check. Dear Mr. Lewis, we're glad you enjoyed our battery. But, you know, that's been long written off, et cetera, et cetera. Would you please give that to a charity? And so I gave it to the charity, and I got a receipt and sent it back to the man who sent me the thing. And I said, I've done what you've done. And I said, in addition to that, for the next 2 years, I'm going to buy gas at your service station. Now, I left out the word overpriced gas at your service station. Because I thought it cost too much, but I did for the next 2 years. And he wrote back, sent me a credit card. So use this to buy gas at our station, you know. So that stuff's easy. I mean, that stuff's easy, you know. That's really cut and dry. That's what I owe, you know. And I know why I owe it. I owe it because I took something belonging to somebody else. Simple. Very, very simple. Then there's the stuff that isn't so simple, like parents. Why do I owe my parents amends? Well, I mean, I disappear for 10 days. They're calling morgues in 3 or 4 states and hospitals and state troopers, and they're just sick with grief and worry. Is that why I owe them amends? Well, it might be, but might not be. That might just be part of it. That just might just be part of the behavior. The real damage I've done there might be very, very different than that. And when we talk about the 9th step, I'll show you how that was so. But what my sponsor had me do, and what I do with the guys I sponsor, is we got 3 of 5 cards. Okay? And each person, now we went through, we eliminated some people. You know, my ego had me, you know, owing amends to people that I hadn't done anything to. And it was my sense of importance. And so we eliminated some people. But most of them remained, and it's not fair to say, I wasn't as mild and meek as I'd like to have considered. But we put each person or place or thing. I had God on there. I had the Catholic Church on there. I had everything that I was angry with, organizations, police, all kinds. I had it all on there. Okay. And I got a card for each one. And in the morning when I'd say my prayers or and this sort of thing, I just looked through those cards. And from time to time a thought would hit me. And I remember, I'll tell you one, okay, there was a guy named Rich Moran, okay, and Rich was my best friend when I was a little kid. And the book says what? We go back as far as our minds can carry us. This isn't stuff I did drinking. This is stuff I did living a selfish, self-centered life. And Rich Moran and Tommy were two guys who were my heroes, okay? When you're a kid, first your dad's the smartest guy in the world. Then one day, he gets dumb, and the big guys are smart. The big guys are guys a year older than you. Well, Richard and Tom were big guys. They were a year older than us, and they joined us in the third year. They stayed back in the third grade, and I asked them why, and they said, well, we like your class better than the class we were in, so we asked the nun to keep us back. And, of course, big guys don't lie, so that was true. And I basically idolized these guys, okay? And I especially idolized Richie, and he was my ideal. He's a great athlete, and I wanted to be like that and everything. And we always were on the same team. Kids are funny. Little kids are funny. They always choose up teams. You know, you get the ball bat, and you choose up teams. And the teams are always the same, but you got to choose them up. You either have to flip a coin, and you have the same captains. They always pick the same guys. And I was always on Richie's team. And he'd pick Tommy first, then he'd pick Richie. Well, we're in the fourth grade, and a new guy comes to town. Well, Richie's the kind of guy who would, he was a thoughtful, even as a kid, he was a thoughtful kid. And so he wanted to make the new guy feel welcome, so he picked him on his team. So I ended up on a wrong team, and I was crushed. And I mean, I was angry, and I was hurt, and everything. And so I had to punish the guy who picked me. I punished him, but I was in the end zone, he threw me a pass, and I just stood there and let it bounce off my chest, and I just looked at him. We could have won, we lost, because I didn't catch that ball. Teach him. But the real guy who deserved punishment was Richie, because he's the one who really let me down by not choosing me to be on his team. And so I punished him by not talking to him. Now, is that a pattern that sounds familiar to you? I tell you, it's familiar to me. I gave everybody in my life one chance. And if they screwed up, they paid. And I talk to a lot of people like that. They'll say, I forgive, but I never forget. That means you never forgive, doesn't it? It means that you're giving people one chance. I knew he'd let me down if I gave him enough time. And that was sort of my slogan. So Richie had to be punished. And it really hurt his feelings. I mean, it really bothered him. And he came to me one day in recess. I stopped playing altogether. And he came to me one day and he said, boy, we really miss you on the team. We really miss you on the team. I didn't answer him. And he said, I got an extra Twinkie. He said, you want it? I never met a kid who had an extra Twinkie before. So he said, I got an extra Twinkie. You want it? And I said, you don't want it? He said, no. I said, you sure? He said, yeah, I'm positive. I said, you're positive? He said, honest kid, I don't want it. So I threw it on the ground, stepped on it, walked away. Wasn't I a nice little kid? So he's on my 8-step list. Why? Because that's the way I treated everybody. I got a little more sophisticated than that. But that's basically the way I treated everybody who let me down or disappointed me. I was a real schmuck. And so we go to our 25th reunion. I'm engaged to Julia by this time. I go to my 25th high school reunion. First time I've seen Richie since high school. And so he's there. And I said, I got to talk to you. And he said, oh, yeah, that'd be great. How you doing with Tom? He didn't look any different. Same guy, you know, probably weighed the same. It made me sick. And And I said, whenever, I said, you know, you're going to think I'm crazy. I said, but I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, oh, one of my best friends is in AA. He said, that's a great organization. And I said, well, I said, one of the things we do is we make amends for damages that we've done. And I said, and I really owe you an amends. He said, what would you owe me an amends for? He said, we were best friends. He said, I really missed you. And he said, what would you owe me an amends for? I said, well, remember when Bobby Harrington moved to town and you picked him on your team? He said, yeah, yeah, you took my Twinkie and you threw it on the ground and you stepped on it. I got it. And I said, I'd like you to buy a bag of Twinkies. I'd like to buy you some Twinkies. He said, no, it's all right. I'll tell you. Now, it's silly. It's silly. But, you know, from then on, I hadn't had to treat people like that. Those things changed me. You know, those actions changed me. Okay? But the key to it, of course, is to come to recognize why I owe the amends and how it fits together. One of the things that the man who heard my fifth step did for me, and what I try to do when I hear someone's fifth step, is he identified for me patterns in my life. My friend Bob Brown, who got sober with Maggie, said it well. Bob said, you know, I used to think I had 20 relationships. He said, in the fourth step, I discovered I had one relationship 20 different times. And what he meant was he repeated his patterns, he repeated his behavior. How many women I've known who always end up with a violent man? Wonder how that happened. They repeat their behavior. And I can't repeat my behavior and be different. So I got to find out what it is that I need to do, what it is I need to change. And that's the work of the eighth step. The eighth step is really, really an important one. It says, you know, we made a list of all persons we had harmed, became willing to make amends to them all. The obstacles, however, are very real. Then first and one of the most difficult has to do with forgiveness. You know, when it said became willing to make amends to them all. You know, the becoming willing is just that. It means forgiveness. You know, you'll often hear around AA, you'll often hear people say, if you want to make an eight-step list, make a hit list. Make a list of people you'd like to punish. Make a list of people who owe you an amends, and that'll be your eight-step list. And it's really true, because this isn't all one way. You know, the majority of the people on my eight-step list were people I needed to forgive, because I had real issues with them, real or imagined. I imagined that they did things to me. Rich didn't pick me to be on his team. He wasn't conscious of my feelings. He hurt my feelings. He owed me. Well, of course, that's an easy one. You know, I'm an adult. I can look back and say, you know, when you're 10 or 11 years old, you think this way. Okay? What he did was the right thing. He welcomed a new guy into town by getting him on the team. That was the right thing to do. So it's easy to forgive that. But it's really difficult to forgive other things. Very, very difficult to forgive other things. And my amends will never work. It'll never happen if I don't completely forgive what others have done to me. And that's why making the amends at the right time is critically important. The book always says in the ninth step that timing is the key to this thing. Well, the timing is getting ready to do it and to do it properly. Didn't take any timing to make amends to Gulf Oil Corporation. Okay? But it sure made timing was important when it came to making amends to my ex-wife. Or when it came time to make amends to my children or to my brothers and my sisters and my parents and so many of the other people associated with my life. I had to forgive them everything. And once I did that, I had to understand why it was I owed them an amends. My brother Larry, who's a member of the fellowship and also lives in Wilmington, a wonderful young man, wonderful young man. I didn't know why I owed him an amends. And I went to make amends to him, and he told me why. I should have known. I mean, I look back on it, I thought I should have known this. You know, when I went on, Larry was born when I was 8 years old, and he was born almost on my birthday. It was a week after my birthday. And my parents always said that, you know, Larry was your eighth birthday present. And Larry said I got cheated. But I don't think I did. I love him. He's a wonderful man. And I wish you would know him. He's truly a wonderful, wonderful man. But he idolized me, and I didn't know that. And I go off to the service, and He learned everything he could learn about the Marine Corps because I was there. And I remember him, he told me this story. He said, I couldn't wait for you to come home. He said, I was sitting out on the porch one day and Mom said, what are you doing, son? And he said, well, I'm waiting for Keith to come home. And she said, well, he isn't going to come home till tomorrow. He said, yeah, I know, but they might let him go home early. So he was waiting a day before I got home to see me. And he said to me, he said, I'll never forget it. He said, you got out of the cab, and he said, you had that big heavy sea bag, and he said, you put it up on your shoulder like it was a feather. He said, I never saw anybody that strong before. And he said, you came up, and he told me the ribbons I wore and the badges that I was wearing. He knew what they meant. He'd gone to the library and studied it. He knew what they meant. And he said, I was so excited I wet my pants, and I was hoping you wouldn't see. And he said, you came by, and he said, I couldn't even talk. I was so excited. And he said, you rubbed my head and said, how you doing, kid? And he said, then you never spoke to me for the 2 weeks you were home. And I said to him, I didn't know I was important to you. And he said, I know. He said, he's an alcoholic too. And he said, I didn't know I was important to anybody either. And I said, if I had known how important I was, I would have spent every minute I could with you. And so now we spend every minute we can with each other. And I'm his big brother, and he comes and talks to me. And I'm always available to him. And he knows now to ask, but I'm always available to him. It's important for me to know why I owe him an amends. You know, being the oldest brother in a family like my family, an Irish family, is a very important position. A very important position. And with it comes real responsibilities. And I didn't see to those responsibilities. And because he was kind enough to give that information to me, I could then reassess my relationship with all my brothers and sisters. And I could begin to make the kinds of amends I really needed to make. My amends with my ex-wife, that's always a difficult one. You know, because the way we talked to each other was with lawyers and things. And that's the way we hurt one another. And I told my sponsor, I said, I'll never be able to make amends to her. I said, we can't talk to one another that it doesn't deteriorate almost immediately into an argument and a disagreement. And he said, well, you have to keep praying. You just have to keep praying. And he said, and God will show you the way. And I said, well, I will, but I don't see how it's going to work. And so one day I opened the mail and I got a letter from the IRS. You know, greetings. We miss you. Please call such and such a number. And so I called it. And a woman answered the phone, and she said, oh, yes, Mr. Lewis, I know. She said, I have your file right here. And we had an agreement when we were divorced that I would deduct Kelly on my income taxes, and Marilyn would deduct Kimberly on her income taxes. And so that's what we had done. We'd done that for some years. And one year she decided to change, and she deducted both of them. So, of course, the computer brought it up, and they called me, and they said, I see in past years you each deducted one of the children, and if you'll send me the divorce agreement, I'll bill her. And I said, I don't want to do that. I said, bill me. And she said, but you made more money, and you'll get, I said, no, I said, I really mean this. I said, I want you to bill me. I said, I am really grateful for this opportunity. And she said, Mr. Lewis, this is the strangest call I've ever made, So I said, well, I figured, what the heck? So I said to him, I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said, I put that woman through all kinds of hell. I said, I can't tell you how difficult her life was because she was married to me. And I said, I've been looking for ways to make amends to her because that's what we do. We try to fix what we've broken. I said, I've been looking for ways to make amends. And I said, I was just praying for the last couple of weeks for an opportunity, and you gave it to me. And I said, I'm really grateful for that. And she said, this is the strangest call. Then, of course, she had a friend. She had to tell me about her friend who drank too much. And so I recommended that she take her friend to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said, if your friend doesn't want to go, you go. Because, you know, we can tell. And, and you know, it's an interesting thing. The next time, I never mentioned it to my ex-wife. She's never mentioned it to me. The next time we talked, we didn't argue. And that has been 20-some years, and we haven't argued since. Whatever it was, it took it out of it. It just wasn't important anymore. Little thing. Now, I've continued to make amends, and I continue to make amends as long as they raise the children. I had some difficult times with some of this stuff too, but with my sponsor, I was able to do things that I didn't think I'd ever be able to do. And I don't know if they were proper or not. They seemed to be indicated at the time. My sponsor explained to me early on about child support and how important it was. And I always paid it, but I paid it because I didn't want to go to jail or I didn't want people to think ill of me. That's why I paid it. And we talked about motives, and he said, you know, you have a moral responsibility to support your children. And I said, I know I do. You're right, I do. And so he said, I want you to send that check first. Write that check first. I said, well, I got to write them all. I said, doesn't matter. He said, very important you write that check first. And you thank God for the ability to support your children. So part of the amends was to write that check first and to thank God. And one day I look forward to it. Look forward to writing the check. And my ex-wife met a guy. I liked him a lot, so which diagnosed him immediately. I won't tell you what disease he has, but I really liked him. And she called me up, and it was really kind of her. She said, I don't think that, you know, I don't, you know, believe this is going to be a shocking news to you, she said, but she said, I wanted you to hear it from me, and she said, I'm going to marry again. And I said, well, I think that's wonderful. I said, I know it's been a hard road, and I said, I really think it's wonderful. I said, tell me about him. And she said, well, he's a surgeon I met in the hospital, and he's all this, and real nice. She said, he has two boys, and I have two girls, and she said, so it should be interesting. And I said, how are the girls taking it? And she said, well, I don't know. And I said, how would it be if he and I take them to dinner? And then I can get to know him, and they can learn that it's okay to like both of us. And she said, would you do that? I said, of course I would. So what's my goal? My goal is to amend the damage I've done. And so Jeff and I took the kids to dinner, and he really is a nice guy. I mean, I really like him a lot. And the kids saw it was okay to like both of us, and they didn't have to make choices. And Jeff said in front of them, he said, you know, we're going to be buying a house and everything, and the house belongs to the girls too, and you're welcome there anytime they want to see you. And so the girls didn't have to carry that around with him. And that's part of how you make amends. You know, amend is making it easy on the people that you love. Okay? And if it means giving something up, you give it up. You know, one day, some years later, this man called me. And a couple years later, he called me, had a partner who was in a lot of trouble. And he said, he'd be willing to talk to somebody. Would you come and talk to him? And I went and I 12-stepped his partner, and his partner got sober. And then he called me another time after I had moved to North Carolina. And he called me up and he said, I have a problem. And I said, what is it? He said, my wife gets upset if your check is a day late and she's happy if it's a day early. And he said, frankly, I'm tired of you living in my house. And I said, well, I can really understand that. He said, is there any way I can talk you into not sending anything? And I said, no. I said, you know, I have a moral obligation to support my children. And he said, I knew you'd say that. And he said, I make more before breakfast than you send. I said, well, I know you do. And I said, I'm really glad for you and for them and everybody. But I said, that doesn't negate my responsibility. And he said, well, you think about it. So I thought about it, and I called him back a couple days later, and I said, I figured out how much child support I would pay if I paid until they're 18. I said, how would it be if I give you that amount of money and you invest it for them? And in that way, I will have supported the children, and my check wouldn't be coming into your house every month. And he said, would you do that? I said, of course I would. And that's what we worked out. So that's how they went to Auburn and Duquesne and that stuff. And, you know, I mean, life gets simple when I'm not the most important thing in it. And that's what the amends signify. The A step convinces me that I'm not the most important person in these people's lives. I've been destructive in their life, and it would be thoughtless of me to not know that. The book says is that, you know, it's like the man who, after the hurricane, begins to say that, good thing the wind stopped blowing. Yeah. Why don't we take a break? Okay. Perhaps we could get started again? Okay. No, we're on steps 8 and 9, in the 12 and 12, it says that whenever our pencil falters making the A-step list, we can fortify and cheer ourselves by remembering what AA experience is and this step has meant to others. It is the beginning of the end of isolation from our fellows and from God. That's quite a promise for a guy who who lived a hardly isolated life. Step 9, may direct amends to such people whenever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. And I like that first sentence. It said, good judgment, a careful sense of timing, courage and prudence. These are the qualities we shall need when we take step 9. I was really taken with this step in the very beginning. I was, living in the basement of a house in the Skid Row section of Washington, D.C., and I was alone, and I was frightened, and I was financially devastated, and so I called up my estranged wife and asked her if I could talk to her, and she came over, and I got this book out, and I showed her the 9th step, and I explained it to her, and I said, so I've asked you to come over here so I can make direct amends for the damage I've done to you. And she said, well, I think that's wonderful, Keith. She said, it's an admirable quality. And she said, I'll have my lawyer get up with your lawyer and arrange something. And I called her all the names I called her before. And my sponsor shared with me that that's the 9th step for a reason. And it really isn't there to manipulate the people in our lives. It's really there to fix the damage that had been done in the past. So that's why a few years later I needed the IRS to help straighten my life out. I mean, that's got to be a first. Absolutely got to be a first. Not a variety of things on this list, because it's very specific, and it's important that we include people, places, things, institutions, etc. And I'll tell you, one of the great gifts of the 9th step came to me as a result of my recognition of the fact that I was very quick to criticize religious or spiritual people, very quick to criticize them, to call them narrow-minded, to do a lot of things. And I realized in my 4th and 5th step that what I did was I feared them, because they appeared to be doing a lot better with life than I was doing. They appeared to be living their lives in the way I would have wanted to live my life, and in the way I imagined one day I would live my life. And so I ended up resenting them very much. And I never missed an opportunity to say something hurtful or critical of them, either to their face, preferably, or at least behind their back. And I know that this was a serious matter, so I put down religious people on my 8-step list, and I prayed about it, and I talked to my sponsor. And I went to my sponsor before I made every amends, with a few exceptions. Sometimes it's so clear and so obvious that action needs to be taken. I took it. But this one, I talked to him about it, and I said, I'd like to go down to a retreat center, and I'd like to talk to one of the retreat masters, either one of the nuns or one of the priests down there. And he said, I think that's a very good idea. So one day I drove down, and I got down there, and I recognized, I saw him, and it was a professor I'd had. He was a young, hep theologian and priest, and I knew he'd understand the significance of this terribly humble act I was about to perform. And I could never get to him. It was the strangest thing. I could never get to him. And I'm wandering around this retreat center, and I kept walking by this room, and there was an old guy in this room, and he was sitting in a rocking chair. It was an old priest, and he was reading a breviary, his office. And he had a blanket over his lap, and he was rocking and reading. And it occurred to me that I was supposed to talk to him. Finally, it occurred to me. Then I knocked on the door, and he said, I said, Father, may I have a few moments of your time? He said, of course, son, come in. And he dragged a rocking chair over opposite his, and he and I sat and talked, and we rocked. And I told him why I was there. I told him I was there to make amends to religious people, and how critical I'd been, and how far off base I'd been, and how sorry I was for that, and how I really envied them. And then he said, tell me a little bit about yourself. And so I began to tell him a little bit of my story. And he listened to me. And he had an expression on his face I could best describe as awe. And he finally stopped me. And he said, stop. And he got up. He's an old man. And he's sort of shaky. And he pulled me up. And he began to hug me and pat me. And he began to cry. And he said to me, God sent you. I said, excuse me? He said, God sent you. He said, I've been a priest for 50 years. And he said, I have an illness that is soon going to allow me to go home. And he said, I've just been asking my higher power where I've missed it. You know, where have I not served you the way I wanted to serve you? And he said, it occurred to me that that many times during my ministry, he said, I stayed with the people who agreed with me and the people I was comfortable with. And I forgot what I was told to do, and that is to go out and find the one who was lost. He began to cry. And he said, I'm sorry you were out there all alone. And I was overwhelmed. And we talked for quite a while about things, and we ended up laughing and joking about things. But driving back, it occurred to me, I think for the very first time, that this isn't a selfish program. You hear that a lot, and I used to believe that. But it's not a selfish program. I believe it's a selfish... I did incalculable damage to the people around me when I was drinking and getting spiritually sicker and sicker. And I really believe that I can do good around me as I work this program and make amends. And his name was Jim, and he lived another 6 or 8 months or something like that, and he did go home. But before he went home, he was able to make amends for the damage that he had done. And, you know, and what amazed me was here was a man who did most of what he was supposed to do for 50 years. And he was concerned about what he had not done. And here I am, who'd screwed around his whole life, and I'm just starting to try to make beginnings at doing what's right, and I was able to go help him. It's an amazing life we lead and live. You know, I had my mother on the amends list, and moms are moms, you know, and moms are quicker to forgive than anybody in the world, I think. It's just amazing to me, and I didn't understand my mom. I know that she used to drive me crazy, and she'd tell those stories that would embarrass you and all that stuff, and it used to irritate me, and you know, it came time, and I made amends to mom, and it was shortly after that that I got my very first token or chip, and it was a 4-year chip. I had decided with my sponsor that I was going to spend a few years being the kind of son that I should have been, calling her weekly, asking how they're doing, being interested in what's going on in their life, going to visit them fairly regularly, allowing her to tell those dumb stories and smiling instead of telling her to stop. You know, I was going to act like a decent son for a while, and then I was going to make direct amends verbally. And she was up in Washington, and I went, and like I say, they didn't have chips when I got sober, and so it was like 4 years later, and I got my first chip, and we were driving home, and she said, you know, son, she said, you said once that if you could do anything, if there's anything I wanted to let you know, she said, I'd sure like to have one of those coins. So I gave her my 4-year chip, and she said, oh, I don't want this one. I said, no, that's the one I want you to have. I said, that's the first one I've ever had, and I want you to have that. I said, I can get another. And every year on May the 13th, I'd send she and my father a chip. And then they would send me a card telling me how proud they were of me. And I really got to know what Alcoholics Anonymous meant to her. She contracted cancer a few years ago, and she had a very slow and painful and beautiful death. It sounds incongruent, but it's not. My mother's one of those people who believe that suffering was something that could be used, and she offered all her suffering up for the salvation and the welfare of her 11 children, then 10, because her son Terry had already passed away from this illness. And I got a glimpse of what Alcoholics Anonymous meant to her, and the fact that I was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and what had happened to our relationship over the years while she was dying. I'd gone up to spend some time with her. My brother Larry, who lives in Wilmington, went with me. And we were just sitting by her bedside, and she's a great lover of prayer. And at night I would sit with her, and I would pray the rosary aloud, and she would wake up from time to time and pray with me and then go back to sleep. And this one evening, Larry and I were with her, and my niece came in, and my niece was pretty new to AA then, and she was all excited, and she said, oh, Uncle Keith, Uncle Larry, you have to come to the meeting tonight. My sponsor Barbara's speaking. And she's wonderful. And I said, you know, I'd love to hear Barbara. I said, but I thought I'd spend this evening with Mom. But we'll hear her another time. And my mother said, no. She said, you boys come here. So we went over by the bed, and she said, you must go to that meeting. And she grabbed my hand, and she said, you must promise me you'll always go to those meetings. She said, those were the people who brought my sons home to me. And I was really got an appreciation for what it must have been like to watch what happened to me and what happened to my brother Larry, and then to watch us come back. I had a great appreciation. for what it must have meant to her. And you know, she died well. My sisters were so good and took such good care of her. Put all the pictures of all the children. They have 11 children and 20 grandchildren and 20 some great grandchildren, and put all the pictures on the wall, and all the daughters-in-laws and son-in-laws and outlaws and everybody else in the family. Just put them on the wall, and she would just look at them and smile and go to sleep and wake up. And her last grand, her great-grandbaby, was about a month old, and she held her, and I have a picture of her holding her last great-grandbaby. And she said, they just get more beautiful, don't they? And she listed the things that she wanted in her coffin. And at the very top of the list was my 23-year chip, the very first thing. So I got some sense of what Alcoholics Anonymous meant to my mom, and more importantly, some sense of what my life in Alcoholics Anonymous meant to my mom. Not just that her son was alive and reasonably well, but what it meant to her peripherally. I mean, she suffered peripherally as a result of my alcoholism. And, you know, she and my dad had never been on a vacation. And you don't do that when you have 11 children. They didn't even have an automobile. And I had a beach house, and they had never seen the ocean. So we brought them to North Carolina, and Dad stood on the deck with my brother Larry. He was watching the ocean, and the waves were crashing and crashing, and he turned to Larry after a little bit, and he said, "Do they keep doing that?" And Larry said, "As long as I've been watching, I have, Dad, you know." And I took Mom, and she just would sit out there at night. She and my dad would sit down on a swing, and he'd put his arm around her, and they'd watch the night come and watch the stars come out. And I asked them, I was moving from North Carolina to Alabama, and I said, "I'm really worried about the beach house." I really was worried, right? And I said, "I wish I had someone to keep an eye on it for me." And Dad said, "Well, we're not too busy." So they moved to North Carolina, and they lived in a beach house, and they vacationed for 6 years. And it was wonderful. And I'd stop by and see them and just had the best time. And then they moved back to Ohio shortly before other things began to happen. But I named the beach house. I had a sign made and put on it, and the sign was CZ Does It. And everybody who knew. So people would stop by constantly, and they'd knock on the door, and they'd say, "Excuse me, ma'am, are you a friend of Bill Wilson's?" She'd say, "No, but my son's a good friend of Bill Wilson's." And she'd bring them in, and they'd have iced tea. I met people from all over the country who said, "I had iced tea with your mom and your dad down at CC Does It." And it was just an amazing thing, the way they lived their lives. I mean, the beauty and the simplicity, the love that they shared with 50-some years of marriage is just an incredible thing to watch. And my mother is, I'm so glad I got to know her and love her the way she was as a result of Alcoholics Anonymous, and not what I imagined. They were taking her in for surgery one time, and so they had shot her up with dope, you know, so she was flying high. And one of the things we had to do before every meal was we had to listen to some rule for grammar or something like that, you know. And so we're all gathered around, and we're ready to wheel her into surgery. The doctor's there, the anesthesiologist there, they're all standing there. And my mother said, "Just a minute." And she leaned up and she said, "Remember, boys, never, never, never end a sentence with a preposition." And the surgeon said, "What the hell is that all about?" I said, "Well, we're going to go get a bite to eat." Mom always gives us a rule of grammar before we go get a bite to eat. Yeah. Wonderful way to live. And to have gotten close to that and to see the beauty in that and to come to understand where her fear came from and how she was driven and how she matter-of-factly sat down one day when I loved her well enough that she could trust it, that I wouldn't ridicule her or laugh at her. She sat down and she told me about what it was like in her life. And she said, "You know, I know you loved your granny." And she said, "Your granny should be loved. She was a wonderful woman in a lot of ways." She said, "You know, but when she drank." And my mother was an illegitimate child, and she didn't have a birth certificate or anything. And she always felt like she didn't belong. And granny was a periodic alcoholic. And when granny wasn't drinking, she was the kindest, most loved woman in the world. When she began to drink, she was a maniac. The only thing that stopped her, she either went to the hospital or she went to jail. And that's how this little Irish woman stopped. The last time she went to court, she was 73 years old for assaulting a 35-year-old male at a bar stool and broke his arm. And you know why? It was St. Patrick's Day, and he had an Irish name, and he was an African-American, and that was reason enough for her to attack him. She's crazy. But Mom began to tell me what it was like to be a little kid, and she said it matter-of-factly, and that's what struck me. She said, you know, when Mother was out drinking, said, you know, she never came home alone. And she said, I would live in terror for when she'd come home. She said, so what she'd do is take a hammer and nails and wrap them up in a blanket and put them under her mattress. And then when Mother came home, she'd come with somebody, and my mother was like 12 years old or 13 years old. And she said, after Mother passed out, they would come looking for me. And she'd talk about how she would crawl out on the stoop porch and nail the window shut so they couldn't get to her. And I began to understand how this woman hung on to everything, how she constantly had to be affirmed and that she was belonged and that we loved her and she was doing a good job as a mother. And she'd constantly say, I feel like such a failure. I used to say, how can you be? How can you be a failure? And so I was able to make amends, one, by making a direct amends, but two, like it says in the book, by living the life of a sober son. And not just a sober son, but a sober son who understood. Somewhere along the line with our parents, something happens, and we begin to take care of them. And if I've loved them well, they let me do that. I think that, you know, my relationship with my mom was one that was very, very profound. But, you know, the one that I think is the key to most of my relationships is my relationship with my father. And I think that's true for men. I don't know about women. But I know I believe that all men have to get it straight with dad before they do well in the world, period. It's just my belief, and I've come to this with the guys I've worked with and my sponsor and I have talked it over, and he agrees with me. And one of the hardest ones was my dad. My dad was a non-demonstrative guy, and I was sure that if he ever told me that all he had to do was tell me that he loved me, if he told me he loved me, I knew I'd be okay. And I carried that for the longest kind of time, and then all of a sudden, I got sober and it was time to make amends, and I had a little 3x5 card and I'd pray about it and things would occur to me and I'd write them down and that sort of thing. And I told my sponsor, I think I'm ready. And I drove from Washington to Ohio and I'd come in and I'd sit down and I'd be in my dad's presence. I'd get a cup of coffee. I'd be in his presence for half an hour. I'd get so angry that I couldn't stand it and I'd get up and drive back to Washington. That happened and I said to my sponsor, it's never going to work. And he said, no, I think you're close. I think you're probably just a few prayers away. I think you're that close. He'd say, you know. And I said, it's never going to work. I can't talk to that man and everything. And I did it again. I drove back up there. I stayed about an hour and I got in a car and drove back. And finally he said to my mother, he said, you know, I like that boy, but I worry about him. He said, he goes a long way for a cup of coffee. Completely unaware of what's going on with people emotionally. And finally, he was down in Beach House and I stopped down to see him and I was being successful. I was an officer with this corporation and I was doing all the things and I was miserable. And I'm a guy who's got to work with people. I can build buildings. I build a lot of them and I can put together deals. I put together a lot of deals and I'm good at it, but I it's not what God wants me to do. But it's what I thought I was supposed to do. It was the next promotion and I thought that's what I was supposed to do. And I was miserable, and I didn't know what to do, and I had sort of drifted away from my sponsor. I hadn't yet gotten my next sponsor, and I talked to some guys in AA, but it's funny. I ended up in North Carolina, and I went by the beach house, and I just talked to Dad, and we just talked. And I said to him, I said, you know, Dad, he said, how's the job going, son? I said, well, I said, it's going well, but I'm miserable. And he said, you are? And I said, yeah. He said, you know, the thing that strikes me, since you started hanging out with those people, yeah, that's you. Since you started hanging out with those people, your life has worked very well, and you've been happy. He said, I'm surprised to hear you're not happy. He said, why do you think you're not happy? And I said, well, he said, Dad, I think I thought success was getting a higher position and not doing more of what made me happy. And he said, boy, those people have taught you a lot. He said, you're a success. He said, you've gone further than I ever dreamt of going. And he said, I'm very proud of you. He said, why don't you do what makes you happy? And I was amazed. And I said to him, I said, you know, Dad, I really owe you an amends. I said, I must have worried you sick when I was drunk and I was disappearing and on and on. And he said, oh, yeah, yeah, he said. And then he told me a story. which made me know why I owed him an amends. He said, remember when you went to work, your first real job? And I said, yeah. I said, I was 13 years old. And I said, I got a job setting pins in a bowling alley down in Bridgeport. He said, yeah. He said, you remember your first day at work? And I said, no, I don't think I do. He said, well, he said, I took you to lunch. He said, we went to Louis hot dog stand. Don't you remember? And I said, no, I don't. And he said, wait, he said, you remember what you had for lunch? And I said, I'm going to go out on a limb, Dad. Did I have a hot dog? And he said, of course you had a hot dog, you loon. He used to call me a loon, you damn loon. Of course you had a hot dog. He said, do you remember what you drank? I said, I guess I drank an orange pop. I always drank orange pop. And he said, not that day. He said, that day you drank a root beer. He said, I always drank root beer, and I think you thought men who worked drank root beer. And he said, and I explained to you about, you know, doing a good day's work for a good day's pay, and that you owe your boss respect, and your boss owes you respect. And he said, I explained it all to you, and we walked down to the bus stop, and I had to go to the next town. And he said, we got down to the bus stop, and he said, I was so afraid for you. He said, you're a puny little thing. And he said, you started on a bus, and I said, son, you want me to come down with you on the first day? And you said, no thanks, Dad, I'll do it myself. And he said, I watched the bus until it was out of sight, and you never looked back. And I thought, what would I have done? That would have destroyed me. And then he gave me the key to the whole thing. He said, you know, he said, from that day on, I never felt as though I could ever tell you anything because you never let me do anything for you. But I was the oldest son in a large, poor family. I thought I was supposed to take care of myself. Amends is because I never let my father do what he did best, which was be a father. I robbed him of the opportunity to father me because I thought I was doing what was right. And he said, you know, your brothers and sisters let me help him go to college and everything. And you never needed my help. You did it all yourself. He said, I'm proud of you. I said, I'm not. I'm not proud of me. I said, I missed the best part of you, Dad. Well, we're both pretty young, you know. I said, yeah, we are. And, you know, a couple days later, I needed to borrow a couple $1,000 from him. And I did. And then I paid him back in a few weeks. And from then on, we've been very, very close because he's my father and he fathered me. This step works miracles. It works magic. And, you know, once I straighten it out with my father, I could straighten it out with God. I could straighten it out with men in authority. I could straighten it all out. The key for me was that critical relationship. And that allowed me to be a father. You know, I had been practicing something for some years sober before this time. I was sober about 12, 13 years when this happened. And I'd been practicing something at the suggestion of my sponsor. And that was I was honoring my parents. And by honoring them, I meant I stopped correcting them. They had lived a long time and done fairly well, and they probably didn't need my input. And I stopped arguing with them about things, and they'd say something, and I remember one time I was having a discussion with my dad. Well, we were sitting there just sort of rocking and looking out at the ocean, and he said, you know what the problem is? I said, no, Dad. He said, the problem's computers. I said, really? He said, yeah. He said, you know, he said, when I worked at the pipe coupling, he worked in a factory where they made couplings to put pipes together. He said, there were two guys in the warehouse. Their names, believe it or not, were Bert and Ernie. They were, I didn't laugh, but he said, Bert and Ernie, he said, they always knew what we had. He said, they always knew. He said, if somebody said, we need 5,000 3/8-inch couplings, Bert and Ernie knew if we had them. He said, then we got computers. He said, you know, computers had to punch holes in those cards. Well, you know, they hadn't punched holes in cards and computers for 20 years, but I kept my mouth shut. That's not important. There was a time I'd have said, that's dumb, Dad. And I'd have tried to belittle him, and I just said, yeah. And he said, you know, if you punch a hole in the wrong place in that card, it doesn't tell you. It tells you you have couplings you don't have. I said, really? He said, yeah. And then you have to shut down the whole factory, and you have to retool the line to make the couplings that you need. He said, yeah, I think the problem's computers. And I said, you know, Dad, I never really looked at it that way before. And I didn't correct him. I didn't do anything. I just agreed with him, and that's honoring him. And I had done that for a number of years. I had practiced honoring my parents. And, you know, the big book says that to honor your parents is the commandment with promise. And a promise is long life. And I don't think it necessarily means that you live a long time. But once I was able to honor my parents, once I was able to make amends to my parents, once I was able to straighten that out with them, then I was able to understand and get along with my own children much, much better. And that's long life. Long life is having peace with your parents and peace with your children. That's long life. And that's what that offered me. That was a critical, critical thing for me. And what I mainly discovered was that my father was a very frightened man. When he ran around, he was foreman of the month for so many months, because he's so particular about how he does things. He was foreman of the month for so many months that they did away with the award. It was bad for morale. Yep. And yet, one day he overslept, and he was sure they were going to fire him. And he was running around saying to my mother, "I hope you're satisfied. I'm going to get fired. We're going to starve to death. We're going to go to the poorhouse." And I mean, it was frantic. And I realized what courage he must have had to live his whole life with this kind of fear. He had alcoholic parents too. And they lost everything. And what kind of courage he must have to live his whole life in this kind of terror and still be the father he was and the husband he was. And how he defined things as right and wrong, and how important family is. And I'll never forget this. My mother told me this story, and which told me what I need to know about my father. My mother didn't have a birth certificate, and when she was 62 or 63, she was going to start collecting Social Security. But she didn't have a birth certificate, and she couldn't prove who she was. And so she got my father and his sister to go, and his sister testified that she was who she said she was. And this public servant said, "Well, ma'am, this is all very good, but I don't know who you are, really." And my father stepped up. He said, "Sir, she's my wife." And ended the conversation. That's what I want to be. That's what I want to be. And he taught me how to be that. And because I cut him out of my life, it took me a long time to learn it. Critical amends. And then it was Dumb Denny. And if you have a brother or sister like Dumb Denny, you know what I mean. I mean, they do it once. They do everything once. Make you crazy. And they just stay with the same company for 27 years or 28 years, and they go up the ladder. Boring consistency. Yeah. And then there's me, who's doing it differently. And I knew I owed Denny an amends. And the reason I owed him an amends is I prayed about it and wrote little things on that card, was because of I had done something called detraction. I was so threatened by how well he did life that every chance I got to say something negative about him in front of the family, I did. And I recognized that that's how I dealt with his success, by trying to make him look like less in other people's eyes. And so I did the opposite. For 6 months, with my sponsor's guidance, I began the process of saying and repeating to them all the wonderful things about him, which were all true, and saying I'm really proud of him, and boy, isn't he doing well, and I would give specific, site-specific examples of what he had done and what he had done well. So I did all this before I went to him. And I got in a car, and I drove to New Jersey, and we sat down and began to have a talk. And his wife, Jan, knew that this was a different kind of a talk. And she excused herself and went to bed. And I was able to talk to him about why I owed him an amends and the things I had done. And I said, "You know," I said, "I admire you as much as any man in the world." And I said, "What I was I envied you. And I envied your success, and I envied your tenacity, and I envied your ability to stay with it." And I said, "For the last 6 months, this is what I've done," and I explained it to him. And I said, "And I stand ready to do anything else I can do to fix this relationship, because I would love it to be the way it was." And he said to me, he said, "I'd give anything to have that back." And he said, "So if you owe me an amends, and I owe you an amends too." And I said, "Really?" He said, "I've always envied you." He said, "All my life I've been afraid." He said, "I'm afraid to drop out of school. I'm afraid to change." He said, "I'm afraid to do anything." And he said, "I used to look at you," and he said, "you didn't seem to give a shit about anything." He said, "If things weren't going well in one country, you'd go to another country." He said, "Nothing seemed to stop you." He said, "You know, you went to Skid Row, you lost everything, and you came back." And he said, "I admire you more than anybody I know. And I would give anything if I could have the kind of intestinal fortitude and strength that you have." And I discovered it. We weren't good and bad. We were just different. We were just different. We just dealt with life differently. And that's what makes our friendship so important to me today, is we discuss things. And I love his perspective on things. I'm just going to make an investment. And I called him up, and I, you know, faxed or emailed him a bunch of stuff. And he looked it all over, and he gave me his judgment on things. And then he's looking at going on the board of a company. He's retired now, and they always after him to go on boards. And he emailed me and some stuff, and I read that, and he wanted to know my opinion on that. But mostly he wants to know my opinion on things like right and wrong. Can you imagine that? What's the best way to do this? What would be most right? And we talk about things like Aquinas and, you know, what's most right and what's most noble and what's most loving. What's the best way I can handle this? He asked me, how can you help me? Can you give me some suggestions so I stop being critical of my wife? And I said, yeah. I said, you know, the same person who's making all these mistakes loves you. He said, damn, that's a good way to start. But the important thing is what we have back is a relationship, and we have it back directly as a result of the ninth step. You know, I went and did a ninth step with God. I went to that back to that same chapel, and I sat down, and I made amends. And I said, I know you've forgiven me because that's the way you're wired. And I said, but I want you to know that I recognize, you know, what I've done, and that I'm the one that moved, and I just want to thank you for sticking around. And, you know, he said he'd always be there, and I believe he'll always be there. I believe that at the bottom of my heart. He'll be there when everything else is gone. And I believe that. You know, I could go on and on with examples of this this ninth step, and I'm not going to do that to you. I'm really not. I think that basically, well, I want to tell you one more, and then I'll let it go. And that was my brother Terry. And, you know, it's difficult to deal with people in your family who have the same disease. And my brother Terry had alcoholism, and God, I love Terry. Terry was the most unique member of our family. He was a genius. He's a mathematical wizard. We used to do this thing, and even a half in a bag, we would give lists of numbers, you know, five numbers, and we would, you know, 54,320 plus, and we would, you know, 8 or 10 of those. And somebody would be doing it on a calculator, and Terry would be sitting there. And when he finished, he'd give the answer before the person could push the button. He's an incredible guy. I mean, he's a mathematical wizard. He could do anything. He became a prize fighter. He was a good boxer. But what he was an alcoholic. And Terry deteriorated rapidly. And he ended up going places I went. He ended up going to the street. But he was the kind of guy, he wasn't like me. He was the kind of guy who would collect aluminum cans. And then he'd take half the money and give it to somebody who really needed it. And he was just that kind of a guy, and I loved him a lot, and he was sober for a short period of time. He came to North Carolina, and he lived down in CZ Desert before my parents moved down there. And my brother Larry was in the fellowship, and the three of us would go to meetings. It was really wonderful, but for whatever reason, that miracle that happens didn't happen for Terry. And I think it's because God didn't need him sober to do what he wanted him to do. But he went back to Ohio, And it must have been because of the way I behaved. I must have been arrogant or something because he would never be in town when I came home. When he saw me, he would leave. And I went for many, many years and didn't get to see him. I would briefly see him and he'd be heading away down the alley or something. And my wife had never met him. And I hadn't seen him for many, many years. And we went back and my parents were having their 50th wedding anniversary and he was on my ninth step list. And he was the last brother or sister on the list. And he was there, and I said to Julia, I said, maybe Terry will be there. And she said, I really want to meet him. And I remember we met on the sidewalk, and, you know, he's an alcoholic, and he wasn't good at looking you in the eye, and, you know, I knew how he felt. You know, he had, you know, no teeth left, and he looked like he was 70, and he was 40. And Julia, of course, being an Al-Anon member, immediately fell in love with him and hugged him, and, you know, and he was, like, hugging a board, you know, how fearful we are, And it was my parents' 50th wedding anniversary. And we had a big blowout for their 50th. And, you know, all 11 children were home and then all the grandchildren and great-grandchildren. And my parents didn't just raise their children. They raised other children. If kids didn't have any place to go, they came to our house. It was like an assembly line at night. My mother would run the girls through the bathroom upstairs and the boys had to go through the shower down in the basement and we'd all get showered and everything, and then she'd wash clothes overnight so the kids could put their clean clothes on the next day. But after we all got showered, we'd all get in the living room, and there might be 15 of us or something like that, and she'd all read us either The Vision of Sir Longfellow or some, you know, Gunga Din or something that was always exciting, and then we'd all head off to bed, and then she and my dad would come to each room and pray with us. And so they raised these kids, and they came back with their wives and their children, and there had to be 200 people there. It was an amazing thing, and everybody was there but dear Terry. And I kept looking for him, and finally he came, and oh, was he drunk. God, was he drunk. And my brothers came to me, and they said, Terry's drunk. I'm in charge of drunk in the family now. And I said, Terry's drunk. And I said, of course he's drunk. He's an alcoholic. Of course he's drunk. I said, I know what he's been doing. For the last couple hours, he's been at a bar down the street, getting up the courage to come here. I said, he must love them very much to be here. And they said, really? I said, really. And they said, great. And they took him in. And that's how I made amends to him, because they took him in. And I couldn't make direct amends because he didn't want to talk to me. But I made amends to him. And it's wonderful. And you can see the pictures from this thing. And there's Terry. About half in the bag, but he's there. And it was wonderful. And about 2 years later, Terry contracted cancer. And I went up to see him. He was in the hospital and he couldn't run away. One of the problems about being sober when you go home is they don't leave you alone. You know, when I was drinking, they used to forget to tell me that there were reunions and things. But sober, they won't leave you alone. And I was home and I couldn't get over to see Terry by myself. So we went to Mass Sunday morning and I said, well, I'm headed back to North Carolina, and I snuck over to the hospital. So just Terry and I would be together. And we had about a 2 hour talk. And it was the longest we had talked in 20 years. And Terry had a lot of questions, and he knew what was happening. And he had a lot of questions, and he wanted to know a lot of things about God and about the rosaries and scapulars and all the things that are important to us growing up. And I just happened to have a few of those things on me, and we talked about things, and we had brother talk. He said, are you sure there's something after this? I said, I know there is. I know there is. He said, you think there's room for me? And I said, all you got to do is want to go there. And we made arrangements for him to do the things that needed to be done. And we talked a little bit. And I said to him, I said, would you mind if I hugged you? And he said, I guess that'd be all right. And he got out of bed, and he was so frail. And this is a guy who was tough as nails. I mean, a great boxer. He couldn't have weighed 90 pounds, and he was so frail. And I put my arms around him and hugged him. And, you know, when you're a drunk, you can't hug for long. And so I only hugged him for a few seconds. But remember today we talked about God's time? In Kairos, I hugged my brother forever. And I helped him get back into bed. And I was leaving, and he said, you know something? He said, I don't think I have to drink anymore. And I said, I don't think you do either. And I got to watch this miracle happen in his life. He went home with my parents, and my sister, Susan, God bless her, came down to help take care of him. And all my brothers and sisters, the same ones that didn't know how to deal with him before, were there all the time, waiting on him, kidding him, playing cards with him, joking with him, playing a rosary with him. All those things, they were all there. And he died after about 6 months, after living in great dignity as a sober man for 6 months. And one night he was sitting up in the chair praying his rosary, and he quietly closed his eyes and went home. And the funeral was a thing of joy. And I got to make amends to my brother Terry. And that's what this is about. It's about living the full life. The power of the ninth step is that for the very first time in my life, I not only belong where I am, but I have things to do where I am. God, you know, as a result of my disease, I brought chaos and insanity to my family. And as a result of the recovery and the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, particularly the ninth step, I was able to bring healing to that same group of people. Now, I'm not the only one, of course, but I got to tell you, I had a hand in it. I had a hand in it. And my brothers and sisters now are so close. We had a reunion last year, and old dad is, my father, that's amazing. I just have to tell you this, and I'll leave it alone, but my father, the day after my mom was buried, he had a stroke. And everybody's saying, well, Dad can't live without Mom. He's 10 years older than she. And he said, Dad's ready to go join her. And they all these, you know, armchair philosophers. And I said, I don't think that's right. So they took Dad, and Dad's in the hospital, and they came in and they said, you know, you have carotid artery blockage, but we can't do that because your heart's bad. We can't operate on your heart because you have a stroke. And he said, well, why don't you do them both? And they said, Mr. Lewis, you're 83 years old. He said, well, I got to be this way for a reason. You know, so I went up and he had the surgery, and he came flying colors and came through it and everything. And I talked to him. I, You know, when he's in the hospital, I said to him, I said, I was so worried. I was afraid you were going to give up. And he said, son, he said, I have to live. And I said, why is that, Dad? And he said, your mom taught me about life. And he said, when I watched the way she died, and I watched the way she gave life to all of you, I knew that to not want to live would be an insult to her. He said, I want to live and be around my kids and my grandkids and my great-grandkids as long as I can. He said, I have a lot of time to join her. And he said, we spent many years together here and we'll spend forever together. He said, but now my job is about life.